Что такое вообще постсоветское пространство?
Все страны бывшего СССР.
От Балтийского моря до Берингового пролива.
Балтикой или Грузией.
Украины, Закавказья, Азербайджан.
Соотечественники, живущие
за рубежом. There's more than one way to build an empire. There's more than one way to dominate your neighbors. There's more than one way to play the imperialist. And with Vladimir Putin's regime increasingly emboldened in the post-Soviet neighborhood, we should expect the Kremlin to deploy all the tools in the toolbox to build its new model empire. And today, we'll take a close look at Putin's imperial toolkit. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is Agnija Grigas, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of the books Beyond Crimea, The New Russian Empire, and the forthcoming book, The New Geopolitics of Natural Gas. Welcome back, Agnija. It's always great to see you.
Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. And joining us from Oxford, England, is Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, author of the books The Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West, and Belarus, The Last European Dictatorship. Welcome back, Andrew. It's always great to have you on as well.
Always a pleasure to be on.
In fact, it's great to have this particular lineup for this particular topic. I don't think I could have done better. Over the past couple of weeks, I couldn't miss a series of data points that suggested to me that the Kremlin's feeling pretty confident about its ability to advance its goal and achieve imperial dominance over Russia's neighbors. We, of course, had an escalation of fighting in Ukraine. We had the State Duma deputy, Pavel Shpirov, saying that, quote, borders are not eternal, referring to Russia's former Soviet neighbors as, quote, so-called countries, and calling for Moscow to take back what he called the eternal Russian lands of northern Kazakhstan. We've had an uptick in tensions with Belarus over energy, meat imports, a proposed Russian airbase, and border checkpoints. Agnija, in your book Beyond Crimea, which will form a lot of the basis for our discussion in the first half of today's program, you suggest that Putin's Russia has long had a plan to reestablish imperial dominance over its neighbors. You call this process re-imperialization, and it unfolds in stages. And let me quote you to get the ball rolling. You write, quote, "This trajectory begins with soft power and cycles through humanitarian policies and compatriot policies, which create institutions, laws, and policies to co-opt the Russian diaspora. This proceeds to information warfare, passportization, which hands out Russian citizenships and passports to compatriots abroad, calls for compatriot protection, which can eventually result in the annexation of territories." For those who haven't read your book, and shame on them, Agnija, could you lay out the basic contours of your argument for us to get the ball rolling?
Well, essentially, I argue that this is a process of re-imperialization. And re-imperialization, I mean, you know, in a broad sense, it's about maintaining and regaining influence. It's about gaining control. It's about challenging the sovereignty of neighboring states. And if the opportunities arise, and if the timing is right, it can even result in actual retaking of physical territories. So what I propose that, in fact, that there is a seven-stage re-imperialization trajectory. And for me, it was very interesting to see how these different elements of these policies are combined. So, for example, soft power and, you know, the reliance of, that's the first stage, as I argue, of this trajectory. The use of linguistic, cultural, and religious appeals to the neighboring countries and the compatriots that reside in them. It's the use of institutions like the Ruski Mir Foundation or the Russian Orthodox Church. So then it cycles through to humanitarian policies, which is, you know, raising the issue of human rights abuses, oftentimes fabricated, really, in neighboring countries against the Russian speakers or the Russian minorities. Then there's compatriot policies, which have become really institutionalized over the last 20 years. There are various organizations in the Russian government, federal, local, regional, that, and, you know, organizations like Ruski Dom, and others that work to kind of co-opt and gain influence over the Russian speakers and Russian minorities that reside abroad. Stage four, this is, I believe, is a real turning point when Russia starts systemically handing out Russian passports to those residing abroad. And, you know, a passport matters because it's an offer of protection, an implicit offer of protection. It's making people that before were just, you know, maybe Russian minorities or Russian speakers now quite a legal category. Mm-hmm. They're now Russian citizens. Subsequently and simultaneously, you have information warfare, basically efforts in the media to try to say that the rights of these compatriots and now citizens are being violated. And then, of course, very soon, then, is a logical next step. Step six right. is a calls for protection. And, you know, then you see where it all leads. It can result in actual annexation of territories.
Now, the only place we ever got to say stage seven is actually Ukraine, right?
Yes. In actual annexation is Crimea. But, you know, really, if we look at South Ossetia and Abkhazia, Transnistria, you know, the Donbass, you have almost de facto annexation mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. territories. And what happens in the end is, you know, as we see in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, we see efforts to try to incorporate now these territories as well into the Russian Federation by, you know, they have now joint healthcare systems and, you know, various other joint programming.
Mm-hmm. Now, are we in fact witnessing, as I suggested in my comments at the outset, an escalation in this policy in recent weeks as Moscow views, to put it mildly, the geopolitical landscape as more favorable to its goals?
You know, I think we've seen an escalation of this in the last couple of years, but certainly, as you say, the last couple of weeks have seen a greater uptick. I think it's because the world attention is on the changes in the U.S., the new administration mm-hmm. that is, you know, getting going and getting geared up, and perhaps Moscow sees this as a potential opportunity. But I think, again, I think there's been a tremendous amount of continuity. And if we see, you know, these statements that, you know, northern Kazakhstan is essentially Russian, that even the Belarusians are essentially Russian, that the Ukrainians are essentially Russian and so forth.
The Baltic independence was illegal
yes,
under
yes,
a constitution
exactly.
that's no longer
exactly.
in force, but never mind.
Yes. Well, so this has been going, you know, over and over and over again. We've had these statements and incidences repeatedly. And some of them even hark back to the 90s again.
Yeah.
So.
No, we saw, in fairness, we did see things like this during the Yeltsin years, but it was not so coordinated. And
yes.
it seemed to be kind of ad hoc, and often it seemed to be rogue elements in the security service pursuing their own policies. Do you see now a kind of an end game here? When people want to be really alarmist, they say the end game is reconstituting the Soviet Union. I never thought that was truly the end game, and I don't think you think that either. But what do you think the end game is here?
You know, I think, as I say, this, you know, re-imperialization or speaking of empires, you know, it sounds dramatic. It may sound a little archaic, mm-hmm. but, you know, the term doesn't necessarily, and as you say, I don't necessarily mean that it's an actual physical takeover of all post-Soviet territories. But it is about having influence over those former territories. And I think it's, you know, I think the leadership in the Kremlin has spelled out pretty clearly that they do see kind of their neighboring countries or the near abroad as Russia's inherent sphere of influence. This is where they almost, you know, they want to have almost a veto vote or right. they want to have the final say over the country's foreign policy, I mean, maybe even domestic and economic policies. So it's an effort to try to reestablish that and maintain. In some places, they, you know, they never lost that tremendous influence, right. I think, you know, well, we'll get to it in the second half, but Belarus, Armenia, you know, countries like these.
And I mean, so in some cases, this is achieved through outright annexation of territory. Some places with client regimes, some places with, for lack of a better term, and with apologies to the Finns, Finlandization. Right? Andrew, go ahead.
Well, I will just say, and another is, you know, the frozen conflicts that are being created. So at the end of the day, you don't have to take over territories like Transnistria or, you know, Luhansk and Donetsk. By creating those frozen conflicts in place, you always have then a lever over the, you know, over the target countries like Ukraine and Moldova.
Mm-hmm. Now, Andrew, you've written quite a bit about these topics and about Russia's actions in the former Soviet space. Is there anything to add to what Agni is saying? Do you agree with what she the kind of process she lays out here? Anything to add to that?
Yeah, three comments, if I may. First,
of course, you may.
Congratulations to Agni for producing one of the few serious, usable books about all of the post-Soviet states. My MA students have to read it. There you go. Firstly, about definition, does it make sense to use the term empire when Russia has all of these other terms floating around, Eurasia, multipolar world, etc., and when Russia has such an instrumental attitude to any idea or concept? Yes, is the answer. Otherwise, we'd be having a pretty pointless discussion. All of these concepts more or less rotate around the concept of empire. If you look at the terminology that Russia uses, so-called countries, weak states, failing states, what they say about sovereignty, it's basically a post-imperial, as in not really fully over empire, mm-hmm. sort of type of attitude. One of the Russian words I think is most indicative is konkurentnosposobnost, mm-hmm. ability to compete. So only strong states with that ability to compete deserve sovereignty. Little states, post-imperial states, they're a pain in the arse, basically, in the global view. You know, they don't have the resources, they don't have the military might to be a serious player in the international system. In fact, they're almost invisible as subjects sometimes, the way that Russia talks about post-imperial space. I mean, how can the words, you know, eternal Russia, Russian Crimea, come out of your mouth unless the Crimean Tatars are basically invisible? Because as a historical statement, it's clearly false. So terminology is fine. Empire, re-imperialization is a useful concept. Secondly, about scope, and Agni sort of concluded by saying there are all sorts of different ways that Russia or end goals that Russia can aim at. Russia is highly selective. This isn't the kind of 19th century idea of empire where you grab as much territory as possible. It's selective between territories. You know, it wants Crimea, it doesn't seem to want the Donbass. It wants certain economic assets, it doesn't want others. It's also selective about costs and responsibilities. You know, it wants the benefits. It's very hard-nosed in its calculus. It doesn't want to be the regionally responsible power, you know, picking up every bill. I mean, it does spend money for imperial purpose where it brings sufficient reward, and we'll come on to Belarus later. But that links to a third point about method. I mean, I don't think Russia is particularly wedded to any particular method in this toolkit. Passports, for example, have costs. Not printing them, but, you know, if you give citizenship to everybody in Abkhazia, for example, you end up having to pay their pensions. Russia uses the elements that Agni has described in such rich detail, but it's constantly looking for other ways, more cost-effective ways of exercising influence. I mean, if you look in Ukraine at the moment, you have this campaign to restore economic ties with Russia, which sort of campaigns traditional fake Soviet methods, workers writing to the newspapers to demand, you know, restoration of trade, with sort of ultra-modern fakery, you know, fake factory websites for those workers, big use of social media, etc. And that's a general phenomenon in Ukraine at the moment, this kind of Russian advance into social media when mass media, if you like, has been blocked on the whole by the Ukrainian state. So method is constantly innovating, I think, in order for Russia, you know, to get the kind of instrumental gains that it wants.
Yeah. No. So, in addition to this being kind of a new model empire, it's also kind of like an a la carte empire, if you will, a salad bar empire, where they're picking and choosing the bits of the old territory they wanted. Agni, I see you want to jump in.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's better than a metaphor I which was lily pad empire. People really understood that. Yeah, a la carte.
Go ahead, Agnes.
Well, but I think that selection and that a la carte, you know, I write in my book that I see three conditions when Russia becomes, you know, more targeted and more focused on particular territories. And that's essentially when those territories have a sizable and concentrated population of Russian minorities or Russian speakers, when they reside on the border with the Russian Federation, and when that population is potentially receptive to Russian influence and overtures. So in the cases that we see, you know, this was the case in South Ossetia, Abkhazia, in Crimea, in the Donbass. This is where we also see Russia step up its actions in relation to certain territories of the Baltic states, again, northern Kazakhstan, and so on. But yes, in terms of the variety of methods, you know, we haven't spoken here, but, you know, the use of energy, the use of economic tools, and so forth.
Yeah, no, and also I would add a key variable, I think, in this equation is where Russia has moved aggressively is with states that are threatening to leave its sphere of influence. You think of the two places that have been invaded and the three countries where there are frozen conflicts to varying degrees. And we're talking about Ukraine, Georgia, and Moldova. And it should come as no surprise to anybody that those are the three states that are most eager to join the West. So I think you're right with the Russian population on the border that's receptive. But there's also this element of it's not opportunism. It's the Russians would call it defensiveness, actually. But
well, I would call it timing in some regard. I mean, maybe it's being perceived as defensiveness, but it's true. Russia has moved and moved more aggressively, particularly during times when there was a shift in the policies of, you know, Chisinau or others, or Tbilisi or Kiev, particularly to either sign association agreements with the EU or, you know, start discussions regarding NATO and so forth. So this was always this type of, but I would say they didn't launch these policies then, Moscow. They stepped up their game. A lot of the groundwork, and I detail that in my book, was laid, you know, even a decade before.
In all of these places.
In all of these places, yes.
Andrew, anything to add there?
Yeah. In terms of groundwork, I mean, a lot of your podcasts have been about Russia's MO, its kind of nature of as a propaganda state. So the other sort of precondition is getting the story right, having an excuse for whatever type of intervention Russia proposes. You know, many of these narratives, you know, have precious little relation to the truth, but you need to prep that before you go in. You can't just go in all guns blazing. And again, when we talk about Belarus, Russia hasn't quite flipped the story yet. You know, Lukashenko still has this popular image in Russia as a great friend of the Slavic world and Soviet reunification. So they have to kind of invert that image if they're serious about trying to undermine it.
Well, I'll be curious to hear your thoughts, Andrew. But, you know, there were kind of elements of that post-2014 with, you know, the Kremlin saying that, you know, Russian speakers' rights are being abused in Belarus, which is, you know, a ridiculous statement to make because everyone is a Russian speaker in Belarus. So, you know, I think there's been efforts, as paradoxical as they are, to try to frame that narrative in that way.
Although even in their through the looking glass world, that one would be damn hard to sell. But no, Andrew, what you're saying is true, because if we had been paying attention, something that jumps out in my mind, and I wish we all paid more attention to it and extrapolated where it was going from the time of the Georgian War. If you could remember, what was the line on what happened in South Ossetia? Saakashvili committed genocide. Before we heard about the Ukrainian fascists, we heard about the Georgian genocide. And everybody, I remember myself scratching my head. And like, what are they talking about? Genocide? This is crazy. But they were pushing that narrative and pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And they still stick to it. that Saakashvili committed genocide in South Ossetia, which he most certainly did not. But so this is these over the top narratives. It will be very interesting. We'll talk more about Belarus in the second half to see what they come up with if they decide to dispense of Mr. Lukashenko. One other thing that's jumping out at me in this, and this came out in some of your comments earlier, Andrew, is when you talk about the notion that these nations on Russia's borders have limited sovereignty and that these small countries are a pain. I mean, this is really one of the key differences between the much maligned rules-based post-Cold War international order that Russia is determined to bring down and the transaction-based international order based on spheres of influence that they want to bring in is that in Moscow's view, small countries have no sovereignty or limited sovereignty at very best. And it's never been really framed coherently this way that these two world orders we're looking at. One of these world orders is one where small countries have rights, and the other is a world order where small countries have limited sovereignty at best. I mean, I couldn't help but notice on social media the irrepressible Darth Putin tweeted a series of photographs this past week. One of them had two officers shaking hands in Paris, and the caption said, "France leaving the American sphere of influence, 1966. And then it has tanks rolling into Georgia. Georgia trying to leave the Russian sphere of influence, 2008. Tanks rolling into Donbass, Ukraine, trying to leave the Russian sphere of influence, 2014. So, I mean, at the end of the day, this is what we're talking about, right? Do small countries have rights or not? No?
Well, in the Russian view, fundamentally, no. But in their disc, particularly in Russia's neighbourhood, you know, they're not really bothered about whether Somalia has them.
Right.
Somalia might be a failing state, but they don't talk about it in the same way. So in their neighbourhood, you know, Agnew's terminology does work. Russia's foreign policy is contradictory. They're always trying to combine the uncombinable. So rules-based order, but at the same time, might is right. They want to exploit, you know, Trump's, you know, permissive attitude towards a more muscular use of national self-interest. But they want to, albeit reflexively, still position themselves in a kind of mirror glass world where talk about democracy, sovereignty, genocide, whatever, all these Western concepts, you know, they exploit them. So they're relying on the vocabulary of the previous system of international order. It's deeply contradictory, and there's a further contradiction because Russia is a revisionist and conservative power at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's always difficult to
reconcile. Yeah, no, as Vladimir Frolov said on this podcast a couple of weeks ago, they don't want to bring down the rules-based international order for everybody, just for them. They want the West to continue playing by the rules, but they don't want these rules to apply to Russia. Agnew, I see you wanted to jump in here.
Well, but I would also have to say that this question whether small countries have sovereignty and have rights, you know, that's also been discussed in Washington over the last couple of years. And I think when people start buying into, you know, this notion that Russia deserves a special sphere of influence, and, you know, sometimes people try, you know, they try to be pragmatic and say, well, maybe Russia does, you know, have more of a say in its backyard. And that, I think, is, a faulty logic, because it does eliminate, you know, the rights of the smaller countries for their own self-determination, because then they end up only falling into, you know, one sphere of influence or another.
No, and I've tried every time this has come up in Washington or elsewhere to point out just exactly what this means, because what this means is you're saying some states don't have sovereignty. And once you get into that way of thinking, we're on a very slippery slope into a very dangerous world.
Absolutely.
Agnew, in your book, you also talked about different drivers of the re-imperialization. You talked about ideological drivers, security drivers, domestic drivers, and economic drivers. And I was wondering if you could just kind of give us a little bit of that. What is the inputs, the drivers of this policy?
Well, I found that there are a lot of drivers for this policy. That's why I think it's been so consistent from the Russian point of view, this you know, imperialist mindsets or so forth. So, you know, the ideological drivers, you know, I think they stem from Russia's history of empire, from its understanding of self. In terms of the security drivers, I mean, it's important to recognize that Russia historically has been a territorial power. It has some of the longest, if not the longest, land borders, you know, of any country. It has continuously historically tried to secure those land borders by, you know, either taking over neighboring territories or, you know, neutralizing them or having control over them. There's also access for them to, you know, the seas. That has also been another kind of historical security quest for them. Access to the Baltic Sea, access to the Black Sea and the ports there, which we can see now, you know, from Crimea's takeover. There's also, you know, and this has been much discussed, I think the domestic drivers of this Russia's more aggressive foreign policy are very significant. Really, they relate greatly to Putin's popularity. Mm-hmm. For me, it was interesting to see the data points. Essentially, when has Putin experienced the peaks of his popularity? Mm-hmm. And all the peak points are after or in relation to some sort of, you know, military campaign. The first was Chechnya, right, when Putin came to power. Then was the Georgian War. Then that was Crimea's annexation. So all three peaks of Putin's popularity. And, you know, that's a pretty standard. It's not, you know, approach that some countries take, you know, rallying around the flag, boosting nationalism and so on to gain popularity for the domestic regime. And then, you know, there's the potential economic drivers. And, you know, these may sound a little counterintuitive because, of course, Russia has suffered sanctions and really has taken a hit in its economy because of the actions it pursued in relation to Ukraine. But at the same time, I think they do, you know, they do also find some potential benefits in terms of resources. You know, let's say gaining the offshore fields around Crimea, you know, oil and gas in Luhansk and Donetsk, removing the coal and so forth from the regions, you know, trying to gain, again, access to ports. So there are, you know, I think despite the heavy economic costs of such policies, I mean, there are some potential economic gains as well.
I would even add a fifth driver there. Maybe it's related to the economics, but something I talk about a lot, and this is corruption as a tool of statecraft for Russia. And that, I mean, I read an excellent report for Chatham House. It was written about how they were trying to expand the so-called Eurasian business space, which isn't based on all these touchy-feely notions of transparency and accountability that we all hold near and dear, but is, you know, murky behind-the-scenes deals. And how, and this also brings in another element of not just the driver, but the implementation, where Russia will use corrupt deals to ensnare elites in the near abroad, in the former Soviet space and beyond, to expand this so-called Eurasian business space. So I would argue that that's another element that we could add to the mix.
Yes. And here, this is where the frozen conflict zones come into play, because when frozen conflict zones emerge, they become kind of gray zones in international law. And a lot of these gray zones have been used by, you know, for money laundering, for trafficking of arms, you know, drugs, people, humans, and so forth, humans, in, you know, it's precisely the places, you know, South Ossetia, Abkhazia, Transnistria, now in eastern Ukraine as well. So again, it's this, they become places where, you know, these corrupt schemes can, you know, take place. So.
Right. And as those corrupt schemes spread, so does the Kremlin's power spread. I mean, I've also often argued that corruption is the new communism, and the black cash of the Kremlin is the new red menace. They're trying to spread this as far and wide as possible. Andrew, would you add anything to the drivers of policy here?
No, Agnew is right. There are multiple drivers here. So Russia's MO, modus operandi, is kind of overdetermined by, you know, at least six or seven overlapping forces. But those six or seven forces can contradict each other. The most obvious contradiction being in the economic sphere. You are, first of all, selling corruption and elite benefits, whereas the message of Eurasian Economic Union is supposed to be about social goods for all of the societies in his states who were members or potential members. And also, Russia's project is kind of the anti-EU. They try and sell it as EU 2.0. But even with countries that are already in, you've had sort of trade wars. Belarus, again, we'll come on to in a minute, which is completely the wrong incentive system to set up.
Right.
You know, if you were cynical about doing it, you'd make sure that those who were in got benefits and those who were out would be hit with the sticks. Russia, the Eurasian Economic Union is fundamentally flawed because it's based on the reality that Russia is a trade destroyer, not a trade enabler. I don't even know why anybody would trade with Russia, even sort of from the broader world. So there are contradictions that precisely because there are so many factors driving Russia's goals. One we didn't mention was also trying to prevent political change in post-Soviet states. You know, so if Russia is the anti-EU, it's also the anti-Obama. He's right. Gone, but if you remember, he came to power on the slogan of "Yes, we can." So Russia's message here is "No, you can't."
You can't. One other thing, also we haven't talked about is the Kremlin's use of so-called traditional values, and this is another way, Andrew, they're being the anti-EU. Deriding Europe as this decaying, decadent, permissive place where they're, I don't know, forcing everybody to be gay and get married or whatever, or something like that. But they're this use of traditional values. We've seen this crop up in the former Soviet space again and again and again as something that Russia's used as kind of the evil anti-twin of soft power, if you will. Agnieszka, did you come across anything like that in your research about the use of these traditional values? You mentioned the Orthodox Church earlier, but
yes.
But in terms of explicitly using this call to traditional values that's become so prominent.
Absolutely. I think it's part of Russia's soft power as it tries to create its own version of soft power. So maybe
it's
America's
like the evil anti-soft power, if you will.
Well, you know, I guess it depends on the perspective, right? But like America's soft power, you know, was long about liberalism and rights and freedom and so forth. And I think the model or the ideology behind Russia's soft power or the message it tries to send is, you know, about return to tradition, return to traditional values, traditional Christian values. You know, Russia now has tried to position itself as an upholder of tradition Christian values. It does have a somewhat unique position because, because of the Russian Orthodox Church. The Russian Orthodox Church has more than 150 million followers. The Patriarch Kirill is very loyal to, you know, the Kremlin. Right. I mean, so he's in a way a mouthpiece for that. He's stated that essentially Putin's rule is a gift from God. So, you know, they have they have RT. They have another voice here. They have right. The voice of the Russian Orthodox Church.
Andrew, anything to add there? Do you see these traditional values as playing a key role here?
Yeah, and there is some traction for the Kremlin here in societies like Ukraine or Georgia. Actually.
Georgia,
they have their own Orthodox Church, but it's kind of super conservative. These conservative values aren't universal values in post-Soviet states, so these kind of strategies can be deeply divisive. You set up conservative majorities, I guess, against pro-European minorities, but or vice versa in, say, the Baltic states. So it divides the post-Soviet states just as it divided Russia after 2011-2012, particularly because in Russia you've got the reductio ad absurdum of legalizing domestic violence.
Right,
you can exploit these issues, but you can take it way too far as well.
Right, but I think going in that direction is part of this foreign policy strategy to present Russia as the bastion of traditional values, and that means that means women are in their place, to put it as crudely as possible. And from their perspective, it's going to have less traction the farther west you go, so to speak. But it still is something of a wedge issue. It's a wedge issue in the former Soviet states, and it's a wedge issue to a lesser degree, but it exists in the West as well. No.
Yes, and there are many. Also the use of propaganda to try to heighten these issues. And that's also, you know, it comes to, you know, traditional family issues, but also now refugees. I mean, there's the same use of, you know, refugees and immigrants in Europe, and try to frame that, again, as a type of traditional values or traditional societies, or let's hold on to our traditional culture and not allow, you know, foreign influences in and so forth. So I think Russia has used propaganda very effectively to try to shore up more support for these questions of, you know, so-called traditional worldview.
Yeah, no. If you watch, I don't know if you watched Kislyov's Vesti Nedeli this week, but it became very clear to me in watching this that the new enemy is no longer the United States; it's global liberalism. If you watch the things Kislyov was railing on against, there was a consistent theme as he jumped from country to country. The enemy is global liberalism. Before we move on to the second half to talk about Belarus, I just wanted to throw out one. It's kind of what I started with, but kind of do we expect now in this new geopolitical environment that Moscow finds itself in or thinks it finds itself in? Do we expect this to the volume to be turned up a little bit now? Do Russia's neighbors have more to fear than usual right now?
I would think yes, because the environment right now still holds a great degree of uncertainty with a new U.S. Administration and with, you know, still a lot of uncertainty what Donald Trump's views will be. I mean, he certainly, during his campaign, he made statements that seemed to imply he wasn't, you know, as serious about America's alliances in Europe and so forth. And so I think there's still uncertainty what is he really going to pursue as president. And I think, you know, seeing this vacuum and seeing this window of opportunity, I think Russia will try to test to see if it can score some gains right now, first of all, when the focus is elsewhere, and then to see if, well, maybe, you know, this can become a sort of type of arrangement, maybe with the Trump administration, where Russia will have a freer hand in its, you know, so-called sphere of influence.
And one has to wonder also, does Russia have the bandwidth to be able to push on all these fronts right now, given the weakness of their economy? Andrew, your thoughts on that before we move on?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how green the green light is from the Americans to the Russians. May turn out to be the case that this much talked about US-Russia sort of Yalta 2, Walmart Yalta, nice rubbish Yalta agreement that they hope to get from Trump, proves to be elusive, that it's a relatively low priority on Trump's agenda in the longer run. But certainly countries like Ukraine feel that extremely worried at the moment that they're going to be thrown under the bus, basically. And that they're also extremely worried about the second factor. Will Europe be capable of, you know, stepping in to fill the gap if America steps back? And there are severe doubts about Europe's capacity there as well.
Yeah.
Countries like Ukraine are doubly worried, and rightly worried, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I think even if you don't get the Yalta 2, you said it right there, we're going to see an America that's going to be less engaged in this part of the world, I think. I'd be very surprised if we saw an America that is engaged in this part of the world. And the other question is, yeah, can the Europeans step up, or can Germany become the new America for a little while? And that still remains an open question. And on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and narrow the aperture and look at the recent tensions between Moscow and Minsk. Is Belarusian strongman Alexander Lukashenko's game of chicken with Russia entering dangerous territory? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is Agnija Grigas, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of the books Beyond Crimea, The New Russian Empire, and the forthcoming book, The New Geopolitics of Natural Gas. And joining us from Oxford, England is Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and author of the books The Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West, and Belarus, The Last European Dictatorship. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Я ему говорю: слушай, Володя, не порти вечер. Вот дословно. Он всегда был человеком, если сказал, Вот с него надо выбить обещание.
Они от кого границу закрывают сегодня? От кого?
It's hard to figure out whether Alexander Lukashenko is crazy or crazy like a fox. Over the past week, the Belarusian strongman's been on something of a roll. He lashed out at Russia for establishing border checkpoints. He rejected Moscow's plan to build a new airbase in Belarusian soil. He lauded Ukraine's fight for independence from Russia, and he launched an investigation into Russian food safety officials for banning Belarusian agricultural products. And all these moves came as Russia threatened to cut oil supplies to Belarus in half, and amid increased fears in Minsk that Moscow is contemplating a hybrid attack on its neighbor. Now, Lukashenko, of course, has been doing this for years, most blatantly since the Russian annexation of Crimea. He's bobbed and he's weaved. He's played footsie with the West, presenting himself as a bulwark against Russia, but he hasn't broken with Moscow. He's managed to be Vladimir Putin's Nikolai Ceausescu. Now, Andrew, you know I'm fond of calling Lukashenko a very good gamer. But do you think this game is about to get pretty dangerous for Lukashenko? Is he playing chicken or is he playing with fire?
Yeah, we've had this.
We've had this conversation before, but it's entering right now. Given the geopolitical changes, given the green light that maybe Putin seems to think he has in the neighborhood that we talked about in the first half, the timing has never been better for him to make a move on Belarus, no?
Yes, but it also makes that extremely dangerous as well. He's really skilled at what he does, but what is he doing? What type of game is it? Game of chicken, that kind of works as a metaphor. The metaphor that doesn't work is a game of balance. Mm. You know, he's not in the middle of a metaphorical plank, constantly equally between the Russia and the West. How about a game of truancy? You know, he's basically a part of Russia's family, but he's constantly tempted or threatening to run away from home, and that's what pisses Russia off, as you said in the earlier section, because the assumption is that a wayward son even does not run away. It's disloyal, at least not before maturity. So Russia overreacts to even the kind of smallest steps. Mm-hmm. So it is difficult for Belarus to edge away. It can create a kind of self-fulfilling cycle of tension with the Russians, precisely because they see any small step towards truancy as tantamount to treason. So he has to move very, very carefully. Russia has already, in many ways, overreacted with this huge symbolic blow of introducing some degree of passportization on the Russian-Belarusian border. A union state still exists in theory. Mm-hmm. If you go to Sheremetyevo and you're Belarusian, you jump the queue like ordinary Russians, and that principle still exists. And reports from the border are pretty mixed. It's not a hard border by any means. It's suddenly been introduced. Not every car is being stopped, etc., etc. But in symbolic terms, this is a real line in the sand that Russia's warning Lukashenko with. And then the other biggie is what happens when we don't know exactly how many Russian troops are going to arrive for the Zapad exercises in a couple of months. But judging by the number of railway carriages that the Russian Ministry of Defense has sent, 500, I think?
Yeah.
The 20, 30, 40,000 Russian troops could be on Belarusian territory.
And they're getting hysterical in Minsk, or in some quarters in Minsk, that this could be a pretext to send some little green men along with those trucks.
Or just use
the troops, or create some kind of hybrid situation. But so there's fears in Minsk about this at this time. We also got the dispute over meat exports from Belarus to Russia going on right now. So there's a lot going on. And I would also argue right now, what makes me think this could be a very dangerous moment for Belarus is that Belarus's geopolitical value has just gone up tremendously with the introduction of the NATO troops into the three Baltic states and Poland. The importance of Belarus and the need the perceived need from the point of view of Moscow of keeping Belarus firmly in the family and not truant, as you put it, Andrew, has just gone up. So you got a greener light coming from the West. We're not sure how green it's going to get. We got the strategic value of Belarus going up, and we have Lukashenko acting up at the exact same moment.
And we have another factor where Belarus has become more important as a gas transit state. Mm. Because before, it used to be Ukraine really as the key gas transit state. But now with problems with Ukraine and the fact that Russia has bought up all of Belarus's gas transport infrastructure, it's become a key country for sending Russian gas to Europe.
Mm. Perfect storm, Andrew?
Yeah, because this all comes cumulatively on the top of two other big changes. One, I mean, in energy terms, you also have Nord Stream, of course. So the decline of Ukraine as a transit state does not automatically benefit Belarus. You have Russia being less generous with the amount of oil that it sends for refining. And you have lower global prices for both oil and gas. From a peak of, I think, about 16 billion in 2012, that was oil revenues alone, Belarus is down to 6 last year. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge blow to its export earnings because it's less important to transit state. Mm-hmm. And the country's been in recession since 2014, which is new. Lukashenko's popularity has been based on some kind of social contract, some kind of instrumental benefits for the general population in return for a lack of political freedom. And this is a long, grinding recession without any clear light at the end of the tunnel yet. GDP fell by 2.6% last year, which is, again, uncharted territory for Lukashenko.
You recently wrote that it's changed from a social contract to a security contract, if I remember properly.
Well, that's Lukashenko's bid, yeah, and it's uncharted waters. If you look at Belarusian public opinion, that hasn't changed so much. Ordinary folks still expect the kind of social benefits that they're used to. So if Lukashenko can't deliver on that, then he's in uncharted waters. Plus, Belarusian public opinion doesn't necessarily value national security or even Belarusian statehood as much as Lukashenko does. Uh-huh. Lukashenko has to survive. That's his version of national security. The other thing that's changed massively, of course, is the general security situation in the region since the Ukraine crisis.
Right.
Although posing as a neutral during the Minsk negotiations, that Belarus sees itself much more in terms of a potential Ukraine than as an ally of Russia against Ukraine.
Agnia, your thoughts on this? And bring in the insights from your book into this, because this is, again, after all, one of Russia's neighbors. It's a very special case, though, in a lot of ways.
You know, it is a very special case. And the way I looked at it, for me, the case of Belarus and Armenia as well, they kind of show, you know, what can Russian policies be towards the countries that are really allies? I mean, Belarus has long been perceived as one of Russia's closest allies. I think it holds a tremendous symbolic, it holds a symbolic role for Russia as kind of their last stronghold in Europe. I mean, they've essentially lost other European countries to, you know, westernizing and going west. Where I see the difficulty is that though right now you can say the relationship is still somewhat stable, I think Russia knows that it can change at some point. People didn't imagine war between Ukraine and Russia as well. And right. I mean, there can be a change of leadership. What is going to happen when Lukashenko is gone? Will there be a colored revolution, let's say? Will there be public protests in Belarus at some point? And how will that change that dynamic between, you know, those close relations between Belarus and Russia? And I think when that time comes, I think we can expect to see more aggressive actions from Russia. And I think Russia won't let Belarus slip away so easily from its orbit.
No, I think they'll fight tooth and nail. But what do you think, the current time right now is a very dangerous time? Because it certainly looks that way to me. at least at first glance?
You know, I would say really since 2014, it has been a consistently dangerous time. I think there's, from my view, from the research I've done, I get the impression that there's constantly the groundwork is being laid on the side of Russia in its near abroad countries. And then there is an effort to try to grasp an opportunity, to try to take advantage of the right timing.
Mm-hmm.
And if the timing appears right, they can make a push for it. And if they're seeing success, they'll push further. If not, maybe they'll back away. They'll step down.
Now, thinking about your stages that you lay out in your book, Beyond Crimea, I mean, how do you see these stages? Because, again, claiming that the Russian speakers in Belarus are being oppressed is beyond ridiculous. I mean, everybody in Belarus is a Russian speaker.
Yes, absolutely. So for me, this kind of move towards information warfare is already, you know, a sizable step. And we also have to realize that there were, over the last couple of years, also in the Russian media, it wasn't always positive on Lukashenko. No. There was some kind of turn against him at various moments. So I think it shows, you know, certainly the soft power is there. You know, the compatriot policies and the various institutions are, you know, active as well in Belarus, although, you know, there are no kind of or very few actual ethnic Russian minorities in Belarus. Essentially, it's just Belarusians who are Russian speakers.
Right.
So in theory, you could call all of them Russian compatriots.
Right.
You know, the whole country. I mean, the passportization issue already that's, you know, ambiguous.
And there's
the move towards. Yes. So the move.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say there's also a lot of personal animosity between Lukashenko and Putin that's quite often written about. And there has been this past week or so, or past couple of weeks, articles popping up in the Russian press that Lukashenko later denied that Lukashenko was planning on leaving the Eurasian Economic Union, planning on leaving the Union state even. And that he was even asked to address these in his annual press conference. But go continue with your point. I didn't want to jump in.
On this point, though, I think Lukashenko can use these threats. But at the end of the day, Belarus is a client state of Russia. It survives on Russian subsidies. It has sold off, I mean, almost everything it could to Russia. I mean, I'm not even sure what they're going to sell off next. Maybe just military bases.
Well, the military base, but they are holding the line on that in a way that I am surprised on. I remember I went on as a guest approximately a year ago in our Belarusian service, and I was like, guys, there's no way Lukashenko is going to be able to hold out if Russia wants that base. And they're like, you watch. And I did watch, and they were right, and I was wrong. But this leads.
Well, maybe it's one of the few levers they still have.
It's about the only lever he's got left, and it's the thing that Russia seems to really want the most, and he's not giving it to them. And this again makes me wonder if we're entering into some very new stage in this relationship. Now, I'm going to ask us to kind of get inside Lukashenko's head right now, and that's a very weird place. But let's try. Why is he acting up right now? I mean, at the most dangerous point, or what I at least seem to think is the most dangerous point for all of these reasons we've discussed, he's choosing to go out of his way to be provocative. And you got to wonder, does he think the best, this is where I started out, is he crazy or is he crazy like a fox? Does he think the best defense is a good offense? I don't know. Andrew, you've written about the man quite a bit. What do you think?
Well, I certainly wouldn't claim to be an expert about what's going on inside his head.
I don't think anybody can claim. But the man is not an idiot.
He's not being capricious. First of all, he has a fair point about the Eurasian Union. You know, it's not delivering in the way it's supposed to. You don't have trade wars against members of that type of union. You don't put up customs or passport controls. He skipped a key summit last year.
Mm-hmm.
The Eurasian the stabilization loan that he got from the Eurasian Bank, you know, is not being paid on time, etc. So he's got very real grievances there, and I think it's fair enough to express them. He also sees
fair but wise. fair but wise.
Yeah. He also sees his basic. He survived as president from 1994 to 2014, basically with the same kind of model. Russia subsidized the state. He used those subsidies to buy domestic popularity. And that is genuinely now under threat. Russia can't afford to subsidize the system in the way that it used to. Oil revenues are massively down in particular. I quoted that. There doesn't seem to be any way out of this sort of slow grind recession. They've tinkered with some things. They have gone up in the ease of doing business index. Anybody wants to
from a very low base.
Try.
Yeah.
But there isn't a kind of game changer. So he has to tinker with foreign policy to try and find a way out.
But there isn't really a way out because he cannot really leave Moscow's embrace at the end of the day.
Because at the end of the day, it's also about, you know, his own personal interests about staying in power. And I believe that for he's safest kind of continuing the Russian embrace if his interest is to stay in power. I mean, I think if Belarus starts westernizing, democratizing, liberalizing, turning west, it's just a matter of time when Lukashenko will have to go.
But this is, and I wouldn't say he's democratized and westernized, but he has flirted and pretended and feinted and, like I said, bobbed and weaved towards that when one would have expected him to rush into Moscow's embrace if his goal is to keep himself in power.
Well, no, he has a choice. He can sort of chase the kind of delusion of free money from someone else. I don't think that's going to happen. China, for example, isn't really going to subsidize him in the way that Russia has traditionally. I don't think Russia is going to return to the kind of generous subsidy that it had before. So the other option is securitization, to try and get others to buy into statehood and his continuation as the symbol and the linchpin in that statehood. He isn't offering the West much, but there are one or two players who will buy into that, particularly Poland. Mm-hmm. Poland under peace, it's downgraded funding for democracy, human rights in Belarus.
Yeah. Belsat is, yeah.
It pushed ethnicization, promotion of the rights of ethnic Poles in Belarus. That's kind of a problem for Lukashenko, but it is something that you can also sell to Warsaw. They're running down Belsat.
Yep.
So Poland, at least, is prepared to buy into this, security instead of democratization agenda.
Because really, if you think about it, Moscow has put him in an impossible position. If his staying in power is dependent on Moscow subsidizing him, and they're not going to subsidize him, but yet he really can't westernize, reform, and modernize his economy because that would be unacceptable to Moscow. He is almost in an impossible situation. So maybe that is the explanation for why he is acting up right now. No?
Yeah, except they haven't ended subsidies. They've just cut them.
Cut them, yeah.
Right. So there's still this kind of hope that if economic circumstances change, they can go back up again. That's happened before.
Mm-hmm.
And we shouldn't rule that out. Although the prospects of Russia's economy recovering, I think, are actually pretty low as well.
Mm.
So it's the most difficult place he's been in. He's been in power for a long time, 23 years now. This is more difficult than anything he's faced before. So he's worried.
Do you think, as we're bumping up against the end, but what I wanted to close out on is, do you think Moscow is contemplating removing him? And if so, how might we see that play out?
Possibly not as a kind of serious reality, but certainly it's playing with the threat, which was one of Moscow's standard tricks or ploys, if you like. So you do have this ramp up of anti-Lukashenko stories in the Russian media that Agnew was pointing out. Not yet a crescendo.
No.
But moving in that kind of...
It hasn't gotten to television yet, too. That's
yeah, and 80% of Belarusians still watch Russian TV, which is a key vulnerability. And the other signals. That Russia is trying to leverage the truant back home, by threatening all these kind of scenarios. I don't think things have progressed to the point yet where Russia's only option is to intervene, because there would be enormous foreign policy consequences for that if they did it in a ham-fisted fashion. So slightly more likely is you know, the threat, you instrumentalizing the threat of such intervention.
Right. Now, in my assumption, had always been they're not entirely confident they could manage the transition and control the transition. They might get something that they like even less than Lukashenko and not something they like more. Yes. Agni, your last thoughts before we wrap it up for the week?
Well, I think, cases like Belarus show that even Russia's closest ally states are under this continuous pressure and threat from Russian... maybe ideological almost drive to regain influence over them.
All right. Well, on that note, we will wrap it up. That is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. has been Agni Agrigas, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and author of the book Beyond Crimea, the New Russian Empire, and the forthcoming book, The New Geopolitics of Natural Gas. And joining us from Oxford, England, has been Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and author of the books The Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West, and Belarus, The Last European Dictatorship. Thank you both for an enlightening and lively discussion.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language program, television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.